What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name's Claire Clark. I'm one of the hosts of the channel, and today I'm speaking with Nicholas Freudenberg, who is a distinguished professor of public health at the City University of New York Graduate School of Public Health and Health Policy, director of the CUNY Urban Food Policy Institute, and founder of Corporations and Health Watch, a website that monitors the impact of corporations on health. He is also the author of the brand new book just out from Oxford University Press, At What Cost? Modern Capitalism and the Future of Health. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I wonder if you can begin our interview by telling us just a little bit about yourself and how you came to academia.
Sure. I came of age in the 1960s, and so I was active in the movements of the 60s, the student movement, the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, and later the environmental movement. And in those early years of activism, as I began to understand how political and economic and social structures influenced how people live, I wanted a career that allowed me to both participate in creating a more just and healthier world, but also contribute to understanding. And so public health seemed a very attractive field, an opportunity both to do community work and organizing work, but also scholarship in understanding the forces that shape patterns of health and disease. After spending some time at Columbia University as an undergraduate and being involved in the movements there, I finished my undergraduate education at City University and got introduced to what has been a really important and wonderful institution, one that is committed to providing people who don't always have access to higher education with pathways out of poverty and the skills and competencies to confront some of the political and economic threats to our society. In my public health work, I've worked with communities and community organizations, city governments, social movements, and my academic goals have been to produce the evidence that could enable people to create healthier, more equitable, more sustainable lives for themselves and their connected ones.
And how did you come to write At What Cost?
Yes, in the public health work I was doing, both with the community partners I was working with and with my students and graduates and colleagues, and I've worked on such varied fields as childhood asthma, environmental threats to health, childhood lead poisoning. I spent many years working on HIV and substance abuse, including 10 or 15 years working in the New York City jails. And for the last 15 years or so, I've been working on food. And in almost every time where I was involved in developing community programs, at some point we would come up against business and against especially the big corporations, and found that it was often in their interest to oppose the efforts of people trying to improve health, that their desire to make a profit and to maintain control was in opposition to the efforts of community residents and governments to improve health. And so I wanted to understand how that happened. And in my previous book, which is called Lethal But Legal, I looked at six industries, food, alcohol, tobacco, firearms, automobiles, and pharmaceuticals, to understand how those industries contributed to ill health and patterns of health and disease. And in writing that book, I increasingly got interested in capitalism and how capitalism was changing in the 21st century. And that's really what led me to this book, At What Cost? Modern Capitalism and the Future of Health.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what happened to capitalism around the turn of the 21st century? So, in what ways does 21st century capitalism differ from 20th century capitalism?
Yes, I in this book, the starting point of the changes I looked at were in the 1970s, after the global financial crisis, after the effort by particularly corporations here in the United States to turn back some of the advances won by the movements of the 60s and 70s, the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, the women's movement, the consumer movement. And there are several changes that I've noticed in the period from the 1970s on, and particularly in the first two decades of this century, and particularly in response to the 2008 financial crisis. One of those changes is the rapid increase in the pace of corporate managed globalization. Capitalism has always been a global system, but I think the degree to which it's global and the degree to which the drivers of globalization became the 500, 1,000 largest corporations has changed dramatically. And they can move goods and services, capital, people around the world looking for opportunities to maximize their profits, increase their market share. And that has really had a very profound influence on health. Second change has been what people call financialization, the growth of the financial sector, speculation, banking, private equity. And that has meant that there's an even greater emphasis on short-term returns, quarterly returns, and that investors have found they can make more money by manipulating finances than by making and selling things. And that has put a pressure on these corporations to make quick profits. And often those quick profits come from putting health in jeopardy, from Volkswagen putting in a device to cheat environmental regulations, from the makers of OxyContin to look to sell addicting drugs to a mass audience. A third change has been a series of changes that people sometimes call neoliberalism, privatization, deregulation, looking to shrink the role of government and expand the role of markets in making decisions. And two more changes I found particularly important. Increasingly, and especially in this, in these last two decades, that the science and technology that humankind has developed has been captured by corporations and used not to benefit humanity, but to maximize their profits. And so we see in many sectors innovations that could help to improve the well-being of the world are used instead to bring new profits. And I can talk a little bit about the food industry, which I think is a good example of that. And the final change I'll mention is the increasing ideological combat and corporations trying to promote certain ideas, the importance of individual responsibility rather than social responsibility, the fact that markets should be the determining governing force in our society, not the public, and the notion that the current system of capitalism is inevitable, that there are, as Maggie Thatcher and Ronald Reagan said, no alternatives to this 21st century model of capitalism. So those are the changes that I think are really exacerbating threats to health. And in the book, I looked at some of the what I call the public health apocalypses of the 21st century, clearly the COVID pandemic, but also the climate emergency, the rising number of deaths of despair, deaths from overdoses of drugs, alcohol, tobacco, workplace injuries, firearms, the growing burden of chronic diseases, particularly diet-related diseases. And increasingly, what's making people sick and what's leading to premature death are driven by the decisions that the world's largest corporations are making. That's what I want to understand and suggest what we can do about in this book, At What Cost?
So the book talks about these significant trends that changed capitalism, that how they've had a tremendous impact on the way that people experience their daily lives. After the introduction, the book then goes on to discuss how modern capitalism has affected what you call the pillars of health. And you define those as being food, education, healthcare, work, transportation, and social connection. How did you settle on these pillars, and what kinds of evidence did you draw on to explore how they've changed?
Yes, I think I chose these six based on the really extensive public health and medical literature that these are the foundations of health. Food, for example, has a profound influence on the well-being of both individuals and populations. And access to enough food and to healthy food influences all sorts of diseases. And in fact, in the United States today and in the world, the leading cause of premature death and preventable illness is unhealthy food. Education, having a high school diploma and a college degree are perhaps the most powerful predictors of a healthy life. And I believe that by understanding how these pillars of health, how people gain them or have trouble gaining them, will help us understand how the world has changed and what we can do differently in order to improve health. There are other pillars of health that I chose not to look at. One example is housing, a very important influence on health. But I think other scholars, both in public health and in other social sciences, have looked extensively at housing. And so I chose to focus on the six so that my book would be readable.
So this book has a bunch of great examples, compelling examples of how capitalism has affected each of these pillars. So you talk about what KinderCare tells us about education and what Walmart tells us about the labor market. I wondered if you could choose just a couple of these examples that illustrate the argument you're making.
Yes, I'll give two or three. So KinderCare is the largest for-profit provider of childcare in the United States. And childcare is a very important support for health. Good childcare promotes healthy child development, mental health, and physical health, whereas inadequate childcare sets children back. high quality childcare allows parents to work, to earn more income, and to feel that their children are safe. And a bunch of investors found that the lack of affordable, public, high quality childcare made that a good investment. And so they invested in companies like KinderCare and moved childcare into the public, into the marketplace, where people's access to childcare was dependent on their income. And I think in this country, there's been a tradition of having education in the public sector. And in the my discussion of education, I show all the ways from childcare to K through 12 to higher education that investors have seen education as a new potential profit center, and in doing so have disrupted and really corrupted the benefits that education provides to well-being. Another example that I found particularly shocking in the healthcare was that over the last couple decades, private equity investors have bought up community oncology practices, groups of doctors providing cancer care. And they bought them up because they thought they were a good source of profit, that there was a lot of money to be made on cancer. And when a private equity firm buys up an oncology practice, they look for those doctors who are most productive, who are generating the highest revenues, and those who are generating less revenues. They fire the doctors who are producing less revenues and bring in more doctors who have shown that they can generate high revenues. And for any of us who've had a family member who has experienced cancer, we understand how disruptive it can be to have to change your doctor, to have to change your treatment regimen, to not being able to afford it. And I think that's a very clear example of how what was good for business, buying up oncology practices, increasing revenues, turned out to be bad for health in a very poignant way. And I also talk about how paying for cancer care ends up bankrupting a high proportion of cancer patients in the United States today.
So capitalism has eroded each of these pillars of health. Are there similarities and differences in how they've been affected? And if there are, what might account for those?
Let me talk a little about food first. It's the subject I've studied most over the last period, and I think it's a very clear example of how corporate-inspired changes end up harming health. And what we see globally in the food industry is increasingly the world's food supply comes from a handful of very large corporations that control our food economy, from agriculture to food production to retail distribution, think Walmart and Amazon. And increasingly, those sectors of the industry have found that it is more profitable and better able to be controlled to sell highly processed food. What some researchers are now calling ultra-processed foods. These are foods high in fat, sugar, salt, and they have really hundreds of things added to them, flavorings, colorings, stabilizers, and so on, all designed to make products that can be shipped around the world, left on shelves, and easy to be marketed around the world. They're also what food scientists called hyperpalatable. They have the high amounts of fat, sugar, and salt that make them almost impossible to say no to. But here's the problem. And here in the United States, more than 50% of our calories now come from these highly processed foods. The problem is the scientific research shows that these products are most associated with the diet-related diseases, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, hypertension, that are, as I said, the leading causes of premature death and preventable illness in the U.S. and increasingly around the world. So here's a diet that works well for the food industry, but is increasingly jeopardizing our health. Moreover, this highly processed diet is also a threat to the health of the planet. The crops that it depends on, soy, corn, sugar, palm oil, produce high levels of carbon and greenhouse gases and are a major contributor to the climate, to the world's climate emergency. Also, that the business model of highly processed food is it's sold cheap so that everybody can afford it or many people can afford it. And the way it's cheap is that these companies underpay their workers. And so we have a food workforce that is increasingly food insecure without health benefits. And so an industry making decisions on their workforce, on their climate practices, and on their products in ways that maximize profits and endanger the world in all sorts of ways. That model is varied in a variety of ways. And I think we in public health, we look a lot at the tobacco industry. Mm-hmm. And what we find is that the practices of the tobacco industry in promoting their clearly lethal product are increasingly being adopted by other industries like the food industry. I think in public health, we've recognized for a while that what people call unhealthy commodities like food, alcohol, and tobacco were contributing to ill health. What I learned from doing work on this book is other products, like even the products of the social media companies, the Facebook, Amazon, Google, also have health effects, creating a platform that makes it easier for people to become isolated, to become depressed, to become anxious, to be victims of bullying. And they choose practices that increase the number of clicks so that they can increase their revenues and so that they can sell personal information about our habits to marketers of those very unhealthy products. So again, the same strategies. They make a profit and our health is put at risk. And I think that is really the business model of 21st century capitalism. Whatever it takes to make a return, to make a profit, and to do it quickly, that's what they'll pursue, even if it ends up jeopardizing the human health and planetary health.
One of the strengths of this book, I think, is that it doesn't just focus on the problems. It concludes with some solutions. And you write that social movements are the medicine of choice prescribed for the ills of capitalism. Can you say a little bit about why?
Yes. So I think as a person who studies the history of public health, I think it's pretty clear over the last at least 200 years that improvements in public health come about when reformers, health professionals, and social movements act together to improve living conditions, to improve access to those pillars of health, safe working conditions, healthy food. We saw that in the progressive era at the turn of the 20th century. We saw it in the 60s and 70s with the environmental movement and the civil rights movement. And so I believe that it is these social movements that will allow us to take on the more toxic form of capitalism. And if we look around us in the United States and around the world, we really see everywhere movements, the Sunrise Movement and the Climate Movement, Black Lives Matter, the young people taking on the gun industry and its promotion of gun purchases. We see social movements and activists who are taking this on. And the weakness of those movements, as I write about in the book, is that we have to a large extent, they've been isolated, they've been siloed, and each has worked on its own. And the strategies that I explore in the book are beginning to connect these movements. And what I learned by looking in depth at the food movement is, in fact, the working conditions of food workers, the climate consequences of the food movement, the health consequences, they're all connected. And so we can begin to see coming together the labor movement, the environmental movement, and the healthy food movement to say, this is what a transformation can look like. And in every community, people are working for healthier food. And over the next, in the coming years, we need to be bringing together those movements to articulate really a different vision of what a food system and what a political and economic system could look like. We need to be thinking about what are their combination of incremental changes, healthier school food, a better use of food stamps and SNAP, with the transformative changes where we have a much more robust public sector and a diminishing, shrinking market sector in food that would lead us to a healthier world. And in my work, I think many people are open to that alternative vision. And I think the defeat of Donald Trump and the new beginning role of government that the Biden administration is promoting, provide an opening, an opportunity for those of us who want to articulate a different vision to advance that vision. So I'm optimistic and hopeful that we have an opportunity in the next decade to take on this more toxic form of capitalism.
Nick, I wondered if you could say a little bit more about what do you think some concrete actions are that people can take? And so the last chapter of the book for our listeners is called From Now to Next, How to Build a Movement for Another World. How do we build a movement that brings together all of these sort of special interest forms of activism?
Sure. So I think there are a few insights that I gained by looking at some of the accomplishments of the movements that have been taking on public health over the last few decades. One is, I think there's a really important insight from the women's movement that the personal is political and the political is personal. And sometimes activists think that those are separate domains. And I think what I've come to believe is that we need to connect people's lived experience, their experience of searching for healthy food, searching for high quality childcare or education for their children, and link that to the political and economic changes. And when people both understand those links and have in front of them pathways to take them on in a practical, effective way, they become actors and mobilizers of change rather than victims of oppression. And I think we need to look for ways to do that. I think the activism of teachers in New Mexico and other states in 2018 and 2019. I think the many efforts to organize tech workers, you know, at Amazon and Google and elsewhere. I think the Green New Deal is a really solid example of putting issues together that will allow us to be more powerful than if we were acting alone. A second lesson, particularly important in the United States, given our history, and we were very much reminded of this by Black Lives Matter, is to put race and racism at the center of the work that we do. For so long, people in ruling elites have used race to divide, especially working and middle-class whites from Black populations, and been able to prevent the unified action. And I think you know, the example that people chose to close swimming pools rather than integrate them, public swimming pools, is a clear example of how those racist attitudes end up hurting everybody, because then nobody has access to those public pools. I think we need to be looking for ways where putting the needs and interests of those most disenfranchised and also most resilient and most willing to fight for change, Black and Latinx populations here in the United States, at the front of our struggles, will enable us to be much more powerful than if we allow people and elites to divide those struggles. So those are a few of the things I talk about in the book.
Well, Nick, I think we have made it through my interview questions in record time. I think this is a new record for me. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with our audience. We have come to my traditional final question, which is, what's next? What are you working on now?
Sure. I want to make one more point before turning to that, and that is to say, why did I put capitalism in the title? And why talk about capitalism? And for many of us who, you know, came of age in earlier eras, we're sometimes reluctant to use that word, afraid that, you know, based on the McCarthy period, that we'll be stigmatized, our careers will be jeopardized, we'll be in legal trouble. But I think what I learned from both At Me Too and Black Lives Matter is that we need to name our systems of oppression. And in my view, capitalism is a fundamental cause of ill health. And by naming it and studying it, and we don't need to agree on what brand of capitalism or socialism comes next. What we do have to agree on is that we need to understand how this form of capitalism that we're facing in the 21st century is influencing health. And if we're afraid to look at that, we're going to have trouble coming up with useful guidance and developing useful strategies. What I'm looking at next, I'm very interested in how people become activists, particularly activists around health, but what's the trajectory from experiencing a problem to becoming an activist? And so I'm hoping in the coming years to really understand how people in the various movements that are around today, both in the United States and in other parts of the world, how that pathway from experiencing trouble securing what I call these pillars of health leads them to become active, and what sustains that activism and what undermines it. And I hope that I can gain insights, and we can gain insights about both how health professionals can help to facilitate that process into making people actors and agents of change, and also how social movements can support and reinforce activism and resist the efforts to undermine it. So that's what's next.
That's wonderful and so relevant, particularly as curricula in health professions are being revised as we speak to incorporate more advocacy work. That'll be a really helpful resource for people. Nick, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show and share your work with us.
You're welcome. It was really my pleasure.